CFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Will you never learn? This is only the beginning. We have many ways and means, but we don't wish to damage you permanently. Are you ready to talk?
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Zombie banking. Banking corporations are legally people, so have we got dead zombie banks stalking the streets of London? We look back 30 years to the failure of Banco Ambrosiana and the discovery of its boss Roberto Calvi's dead body hanging underneath Blackfriars Bridge. What are the lessons from Calvi's murder and that banking collapse and fraud might we learn today? Plus, postponed from last week, the murder 10 years ago of nationalist journalist Martin O'Hagan, and revelations in last week's Guardian that his killers were working closely with and being protected by even British security forces. And the euro crisis has been kicked away this week, but so long as the finance ministers fail to act, it's going to bounce back. We hear from a former bank boss, Michael Hudson, how the crash is being orchestrated by any real debate being closed down by euro finance ministers. But first, the biggest changes in 60 years as to who is and who isn't allowed to build in the countryside, freeing land for developers. But will we see massive shoebox housing estates, eco-villages, or just nuclear power stations? Mike Birkins here from Southwest Friends of the Earth to explain who will and will not be able to build. Hi, Mike, and welcome to Drive Time. So what are these changes that are being brought in by the coalition government to planning in the countryside? Because the most important thing I keep hearing, certainly from the mouth of Mr. Cameron himself, is that local people will be deciding, which sounds to me as if they won't be building anything, because that's the NIMBY syndrome, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The government came up with proposals that are now being pushed forward through its localism bill, that you could have neighbourhood plans where a group of now it seems to be 21 people, originally it was going to be three, but a group of 21 people could, if they got the resources together, come up with a plan for what they wanted to see happening in their area. And this sounded like, radical and to be welcomed. It's allowing local people to take much more control over what can happen. Since the original proposals came forward, it seems to have been somewhat hijacked by Treasury interests, and they're using this as part of a much more widespread drive to deregulate the planning system. So in parallel with what's going on in Parliament through the localism bill, the government is also proposing to rewrite all the planning guidance that they give to local councils and replace what is currently, I believe, 22 documents stretching to about 1,000 pages into one 50-page document. And again, you think, well, in principle, hooray, making planning much simpler. But actually what they're doing at the same time is taking away a lot of the checks and balances that currently regulate who is allowed to build what where. And the fear is that this is being driven through because deregulating the planning system will encourage a lot more economic activity. But is it going to be the right kind of economic activity? If you look at places that have deregulated their planning, you're looking at countries like Ireland and Greece and Spain, and it's been speculative building and development activity that is actually the bubbles in those kinds of activities that have actually led to the economic collapse in those countries.
Now, this might be a controversial thing to say, but it sounds to me like a deregulation.
Well, I think that is certainly partly what lies behind it, and in the government is certainly the input that the Treasury has had has been very much a deregulatory impulse. They've sort of very much signed up to this ideology that economic development has been held back because we have a planning system, and let's make the planning system less of a so-called burden, and we'll get faster economic development. But you know, in doing so, do you actually sacrifice the quality of built environment, the quality of countryside? Do you end up with the kind of development that just stores up problems for the future?
I mean, isn't it just a simple fact that agricultural land, the greenbelt land, is actually very cheap because you can't build on it? So you can really just use it for pasture and agriculture. The land changes hands for a few thousand pounds an acre, whereas in the city, the more brownfield sites, industrial sites, they can be, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 times more. And that this deregulation is simply going to allow developers to buy and build on the cheap land rather than brownfield sites.
That's and that will create on the books a massive upsurge in the value of that land, and you know, it seems to be creating economic growth. But if all you end up with is, you know, speculative allocations of land, housing being built in the wrong place, with all the consequences that has in terms of congestion, you know, people having to travel many, many miles between where they work and where they live, ultimately the communities, both the countryside and cities like Bristol, will be the losers.
So what's Friends of the Earth's national position on this, and what way is the campaign actually, what's the campaign doing about it?
Well, we think the government is proposing that there should be a presumption in favour. That means to say that councils, when they're faced with a planning application, should be presumed to be going to say yes. A presumption in favour of what they call sustainable development. Now, that's good. We're all in favour of sustainable development. But if the government then fails to define what they actually mean by it, then it just opens the floodgates to anything that
anybody
wants.
This is
one
of those funny words, isn't it, that started off meaning sustainability, started off meaning that it was ecologically sustainable. In other words, that it wouldn't make a mess, and that actually you could return the land to its original state quite easily. Now it seems to mean that sustainable just means whether it can make money or not.
You've got it there. I think that sustainable, if it means sustainable in terms of respecting the limits of the environment to take development, it's sustainable if it means accepting that you want to have a social benefit from development as well as economically sustainable, then that's good. But if all the government means is sustainable in terms of it makes lots of money indefinitely into the future, then that is clearly a much more damaging definition, and it does mean that we actually end up just creating as many problems through this development as we solve.
But I mean, I'm sure you can see where the coalition government's coming from here, because they're looking around, they're seeing, well, actually there's not the developments going on that we'd like to see simply because of the recession. It's impossible, to a large extent, or maybe it's not so profitable, should I say, not impossible, for developers to be buying up brownfield sites in the cities and building on them. And this is one way to actually kickstart the development process by actually starting to allow developers to build on these cheaper greenfield land.
Yeah, but thereby you actually make it less likely that the more desirable developments in city centres will happen, because the investment will go to the cheaper and easier things. So it doesn't actually benefit the economy of cities to unleash a wave of speculative building on the outskirts.
So Martin, how does this all fit in with what we were talking about earlier, which is just the sort of general economic climate?
Well, I mean, this is basically ideological. I mean, they're just pursuing deregulations. The property development industry, as it were, have getting their pound of flesh.
So, what ideal world are they pursuing then?
Well, I mean, the idea is that the more they deregulate the economy, the more it will magically, spontaneously regenerate from the fact that it's being nuked. But it won't. It's a fantasy, basically.
Okay, so what should they be doing then? Because, I mean, I've just put that to Mike, because what I'm saying is that because of the financial situation, it's very difficult for developers to build on these brownfield sites, to buy them in the first place to build on. This is actually a way of sort of helping to kickstart the economy,
isn't
it?
It's a way of keeping them happy. I mean, what we've actually got to do is actually have an idea of a sustainable economy. And have a plan.
Now, which version of the word are you talking about there?
The word in its proper sense was originally used by Gro Harlem Brundtland in the Brundtland Report in the early 80s. And she said sustainable development is development which helps current generations without compromising the welfare of future generations. So, I mean, we need actually to have a sustainable development plan for the whole economy within which property developers and others will operate. we haven't got anything like that or even a desire to have such a thing.
Well, that sounds like a nice definition. Mike, is it possible to do that and to have economic growth and developers able to afford to build in, presently?
Yeah, it certainly is possible to do that. It may be not so easy to have the kind of massive investment in development sites in and around Bristol that we have seen in recent decades, but that is all the more reason for ensuring that we actually don't get low quality short term development. I went this morning on a trip around the area around Temple Meads station, which has been declared to be the Bristol Enterprise Zone, and that is a manifestation of exactly the kind of thinking that Martin's just been describing. If you sort of tear up enough red tape and say we're going to have economic growth in this area, economic growth will magically follow. Now, I was impressed that the people that I was with, the planners and economic development people from Bristol, they clearly don't subscribe to that sort of short-term naive vision of what the enterprise zone ought to be. But I'm concerned that they're talking at cross purposes with the government, who just want them to kind of get as much uplift in the value, as many jobs in the area as they possibly can, as quickly as possible, and do so in a way that doesn't respect the long-term prosperity.
So what's your thoughts about this enterprise zone now? Is it going to work?
I think it could bring some benefits to the city, undoubtedly, and we might get some good quality new development out of it, but so long as the government doesn't sort of try and steer it too much towards the short-term gain. It's ironic that you're looking around that area. This was 20 years ago an area that was benefited or otherwise from a previous government initiative. It was the land that was owned by the Bristol Development Corporation, and they very much did pursue this short-term vision. And what have we got out of it? Well, we got a road on stilts, a bowling alley, a 10-screen cinema, not very much else, or a big roundabout outside Temple Meads station. I don't think there's really much of a legacy that the city can say that we really benefited from having that short-term approach to developing that area. And I genuinely believe the City Council is very anxious not to repeat the mistakes of the past, but they have a job on their hands.
Yes, yeah, so I was going to say, is there any evidence that this time it's all going to be different?
Well, that's all to be played for, and that's why the enterprise zone is actually quite an important thing for us to be turning our attention to now, because undoubtedly there are those who want to see the short-term model applied and just get as much stuff built as fast as you possibly can, if the market would ever even deliver it in any case, and those who are concerned to see this, well, this is an opportunity to do something with an area of the city, you know, look over beyond Temple Meads station, where the skeleton of the old GPO sorting office now stands, and the derelict land which has been talked about as a site for a stadium, but nothing has actually happened for 10 years 20 years. So it's an opportunity to get some sensible planning and investment in that area, but I say there's a fight on our hands.
Martin, do you think the economic climate's there to be building in places like this at the moment? And one of my concerns is that what we saw at Temple Quay was just a load of offices go up, where actually there's now a massive surfeit of offices in the city, and this has meant that as businesses moved into these new offices at Temple Quay, it just leaves loads and loads of other offices empty. I mean, surely what we need is in the city is more housing.
Well, I mean, enterprise zones, by their definition, are likely to take development away from somewhere else. It's basically, you know, you're just moving around whatever development resources you've got. And actually, I mean, don't forget that the Temple Quay development was in a property boom. We're not going to have a property boom. And it may be that nobody will actually want to develop anything there, even with an enterprise zone, if we get into a serious slump, which I'm afraid we are.
What are the basic incentives then for people to be building around this new zone at Temple Meads, Mike?
The government is going to offer a tax holiday, basically. You get a business rate relief for, I think it's up to 20 years. I think the companies that move in there get 5 years. I might be getting this wrong, but I think companies that move in there get 5 years relief, but the receipts are then kept by the local enterprise partnership, the people that have set up the enterprise zone, and they get 20 years benefit from the business rates. So we are talking potentially quite serious money, but given the state of the property market, whether that is going to be sufficient to encourage people to build big style high-end office developments there. So I think the city would do much better to look at some much more kind of temporary and homegrown uses. Part of the enterprise zone we went and looked at this morning is the paintworks off the Bath Road, and I think that's a really nice example of where what was a derelict area has been refurbished and brought back to life in a really quite a vibrant way, with relatively little in the way of grandiose redevelopment. The shells of the buildings that were there have basically been reused, and that's now a really kind of prosperous area, at the cost of relatively little investment in terms of, you know, flattening it and starting all over again and putting up lots of concrete and steel.
Well, what's the prospect of some sort of transport hub there? Because you would think it would make sense, being right next already to one of the biggest railway stations in the country. You've got people coming in and out. It would seem to make sense at Temple Meads to have some kind of, whether it's a tram. I mean, you can't really... they've only just rebuilt the bus station, haven't they? So they can't really build that there. But isn't there an opportunity there for some sort of integration of the transport?
That's right. I think it's absolutely essential that the transport integration forms a really major part of this proposal, and it would be not only a wasted opportunity but actually a really seriously long-term damaging development for the city if we turned our back on that and didn't make sure that it was a transport hub for where people coming off the trains could connect with good bus routes, they could connect with ferry routes, and that there are good cycle and walking routes through the area as well. We went round this morning on cycling around the area, and it really was, although the potential is there, it really was quite a sort of obstacle course, the number of times you had to sort of go over main roads and stop sort of follow around sort of little back alleys that didn't really seem to make much sense. There really is a difficulty at the moment getting through that area on foot or by bicycle, and that could be radically improved. And again, that's a sort of low cost improvement that is going to really change the feel of the area, encourage people to use it in the right way, and could help with the economic regeneration that we need in that area without huge scale infrastructure.
Well, from the city to the country and from Temple Meads down to Bridgewater with a nuclear train that goes once a week, what's happening with the whole situation with EDF Energy and the other energy companies and the potential to build these two new nuclear power stations near Bristol? I think certainly most of the country has got its eyes on Hinkley Point, the possible Hinkley 3 power station being built, and how do the planning rules affect these new planning rules that the coalition are bringing in effect, the likelihood of that happening or not?
Well, these planning rules actually have already been changed, and this was under the previous government. So the system for big scale infrastructure, major infrastructure projects, has already been changed, and it has been changed in such a way that puts it on a fast track timetable, basically. So we are expecting that EDF will put in their planning application sometime this autumn. So it could be quite soon. Now, there are some legal challenges in the offing. Greenpeace have legally challenged the government's national planning framework on nuclear power. And I understand that Stop Hinkley are looking at a legal challenge to the grantee of planning permission to EDF to clear the site. So those could hold things up. But nevertheless, if the system goes ahead according to the way it's been promoted at the moment, then we could be seeing the planning application coming through late this year, early next year, and then it works on a timetable which has to finish within 6 months. So
right,
the planning decision has to be made.
So how likely is that then under the new system just to go through on the nod?
Well, it won't go through on the nod, but it will be a much more difficult system for local people and other interests to have access to, because it goes very fast, because most of it is done through written exchange of documents rather than through hearings where you can stand up and have your say. You don't have the right, which you had under the old planning system, to put questions directly, to cross-question the developers. So actually, it's done. It's all done very remotely. The chance that anybody that's objecting to Hinckley C and EDF actually being in the same room at the same time and able to talk to each other and actually question each other is very small under this new system. Doesn't necessarily happen that way at all. So you have to rely on these appointed commissioners to read everybody's submissions and come to the conclusions themselves.
Now, Martin, you're slightly smiling there and rolling your eyes around at this new system for giving approval to nuclear power stations without people actually ever meeting each other, it seems. But what about the economic side of it? Because we were hearing last week that actually EDF is massively in debt. These people that want to build this power station, incredibly, massively in debt to the French government as it stands.
Yeah, but
without this new power station.
The problem is with EDF, because the French have invested so much in nuclear power that they've really got to sell it on. It's like they're addicted to heroin, but they can't afford it anymore, so they've got to sell it to other people. And I'm afraid that even in a crash, which I suspect is what's going to happen, people then get even more desperate to sell what they've got. And the French made a decision a generation ago that they were going to go for nuclear power, and so they're desperate to sell it on. But I think after Fukushima, for example, you've got the Germans who are going to wind down their nuclear power industry. I think those who are opposed to Hinckley Point should stick with it, because it may be that they're going to win.
Well, Mike, maybe you could just remind us how to get in touch with Friends of the Earth and what whereabouts you are, Friends of the Earth Southwest.
Yep. Well, the best way for people to get involved is through the local group, which is Bristol Friends of the Earth, and that's you can find it website www.bristolfo.org. We do have open meetings, which are on the second Tuesday of the month in the Big Chill Bar in Small Street, and we will be putting on some larger public meetings in the autumn, but I haven't got details of those yet confirmed.
And can you just give us a phone number?
Yep, you can phone me on Bristol 9420128. That's 0117 942 0128.
Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us. And we have Zombie Banks and Oligarchs after some music.
Everyone sing.
It's not about the money.
We don't need your money.
forget about the price tag.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
And that was Jessie J, Who You Are. Thanks very much to Red for letting us borrow that. Now, on to our oligarchs. And the two oligarchs are going to war this week. Roman Abramovich and Boris Berezovsky are in a £3 billion fight. Flanking Roman Abramovich as he strode into court yesterday were an intimidating set of corporate henchmen. Carol Nairn heads the arbitration division at Skadden, one of London's fearsome four law firms. So, Martin, why are these two oligarchs, both living in London, Roman Abramovich and Boris Berezovsky, locked in a legal fight together?
It's a business disagreement that they've had. Berezovsky claims that Abramovich forced him to sell shares at a knockdown price. I presume it may be connected to the fact that Berezovsky has been kicked out of Russia and that Abramovich is still able to go back there. So Berezovsky's businesses inside Russia have become vulnerable to take over by Abramovich. But, I mean, all of these people are... I mean, isn't it extraordinary that these people are having their fights in our courtrooms?
Yeah, Boris Berezovsky's aged 65. He's got apparently a £500 million fortune, although it was actually $3 billion back in 1997, after importing Mercedes cars into Russia. He took control of something called the Sibneft Oil Company in Russia's main TV channel, ORT. So he's a kind of what you might call a Russian version of Silvio Berlusconi.
He was. He was. And he was very close to Putin before... when Putin first came to power, Berezovsky and Putin were very much in bed together, and Abramovich and all of the oligarchs. Putin came to power, if you remember, as a result of the election of 1999, and that was after the Moscow and Ryazan bombings, which were covered in Litvinenko's book Blowing Up Russia, whereas an ex-FSB agent, which the new KGB, as it were, he was basically saying it wasn't the Chechens that bombed Moscow and Ryazan, it was the FSB and Putin, and I helped him do it. Berezovsky and Putin cooked that up together to keep the communists and Zyuganov out of power in the election of November 1999. Berezovsky is a very interesting character because he's been best friends with Putin and fell out with Putin, and now he's best friends with Dick Cheney. Very interesting person.
Well, he's kind of crossed the line there, hasn't he? Yeah. Almost totally.
Yep. But then gangsters, there's no honour among thieves. Gangsters fall out, they form new alliances. Well, I mean, Berezovsky has been on Putin's gang and is now on Cheney's gang.
Well, is there actually any real evidence that he's, as you say, they're a gangster? Because, I mean, surely that's just an allegation.
Well, I mean, they would say, but what Abramovich is saying, I did read a bit of his comments the other day, he's saying that business practices in Russia at that period were so complicated and crazy, you don't understand what it was like. It was like the Wild West, and you can't judge what it was doing then by the situation now. And basically, the oligarchy got hold of all of Russia's serious assets in the privatisation process brought in by Yeltsin and Chubais. The reason I know a bit about this is because I used to work in the region as an economic advisor and as an aid worker. And these people are falling out amongst themselves, which gives us an interesting insight into what goes on behind the scenes. But they are really the beneficiaries of the collapse of the communist system and the introduction of wild capitalism.
Now, one of the interesting sidelines to all this is the allegations over the death of Litvinenko, the guy who was poisoned by polonium. So what are your thoughts about, you know, who might have been responsible for that? Because we're seeing, again, in the recent visit of our Prime Minister David Cameron over to Moscow, accusations that actually it was Putin and his allies that were responsible for that.
Well, I mean, they're the obvious suspects in the first, you know, the first chapter of the Agatha Christie novel.
But you're saying at the time that actually Putin was working quite closely with him?
No. The Berezovsky had already fallen out with Putin by this stage. Berezovsky and Putin fell out soon after Putin was elected because Berezovsky thought Putin was going to be his puppet, a bit like Krupp and Hitler. And it turned out that Hitler was stronger than Krupp, and it turned out that Putin was stronger than Berezovsky. The whole oligarchy were kept in power by Putin's election victory, and the communists were kept out.
Now,
so the oligarchy were happy with that, but Putin then said, right, you are now dependent on me. He comes from the section of the Russian elite known as the Siloviki, and their source of power is not so much in the economy, it's in the security structure. And they basically done a deal with the oligarchs, which is we will protect you and allow you to have your ill-gotten gains, but we, you know, you've got to pay us off, basically. So Berezovsky then fell out with Putin, and Berezovsky and Putin have been bitter enemies ever since. So the suggestion that, and don't forget, Litvinenko was an ex-FSB man who was basically accusing
the FSB being the secret service in Russia,
secret service, the internal secret service, and he's basically, you know, their version of MI5, if you like. He's accusing Putin of being behind the Moscow and Ryazan bombings, which killed several hundred people. It was a false flag terror event, which we talk frequently on this kind of program, similar to 9/11.
This is what actually kicked off the war in Chechnya.
Chechnya was independent at this stage. The Chechens had no motive whatsoever for planting bombs in working class housing estates in Moscow and Ryazan. They'd already got their independence. They were completely separate from Russia, and basically there was no reason for them to do it.
So what was the motive then?
Because the Communist Party were looking as if they were going to win the election, the presidential election of November 1999. Zyuganov had been a low-level Communist Party official. He was now the leader of the Russian Communist Party. And at that stage, the ordinary people in Russia had lost everything. The economy had been privatised. It was in the hands of the oligarchy. And it was all done very, very opaquely. So, you know, people ended up with massive amounts of money. Not because they built these businesses up. They just basically cherry-picked all the best stuff, which should, in my view, have been kept in the public sector. Turned into profit, but kept in the public sector, so that the public sector then got the money back, which would have allowed Russia to rebuild and so on and so forth.
So at this point, Berezovsky was very pally with Putin.
Yes. Putin was brought in by the oligarchy, and Berezovsky was the key figure. He was the leader of the oligarchy, if you like, because he was the Berlusconi figure, just as Berlusconi is the leader of the oligarchy in Italy. It's not just him, he's got chums. And Berezovsky, you know, Putin was a very obscure St. Petersburg official with a KGB background, and he was suddenly catapulted to national prominence as a result of the bombings. And Putin was a strong hand who was going to deal with these Chechen marauders, blah blah blah. And of course he rode to victory on a white horse in the election. Zyuganov was pushed aside, and the communists were finished as a major political force in Russia. They still exist, but they've been marginalised by this new machine of Putin's.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, 10 years ago last week, Sunday World investigative journalist Martin O'Hagan was shot dead in the street in the northern Irish town of Lurgan in front of his wife on his way home. He was a nationalist writer who'd been digging out stories about the very people, it appears, shot him. Yet, despite four names being given at a very early stage by his friends and colleagues to the Police Service of Northern Ireland at the RUC, nobody has yet been charged nor interviewed for the crime. The central rumour surrounding Marty's murder is that the killer was a police or MI5 informer, and a trial would blow his cover and be embarrassing for the British government. Well, Martin, now you did spend some time in Northern Ireland before the Good Friday Agreement was signed, which was about a year before Martin O'Hagan was killed. So the most crucial thing here, I suppose, is how come he was shot after the Troubles ended?
Well, he's it's obviously, this is speculative, but I mean, basically he was researching the criminal activities of the loyalist paramilitaries after the peace agreement was signed.
But these are even the fringe paramilitaries. I can remember hearing at the time of Martin's article on something called the Red Hand Defenders.
Yeah. Well, don't forget that the loyalist side is much more fragmented than the Republican side. I mean, there is fragmentation on the Republican side, of course, but the loyalist paramilitaries have got an opaque structure, and some of them have been, you know, exemplary since the peace agreement was signed. I think of the late David Irving, who I met once, who was a very sensible guy. He was basically a politician. He ended up as a terrorist. But of course, many of them were gangsters, and they've carried on being gangsters after the peace agreement was signed. And Martin O'Hagan was looking into their criminal activities, and I think that's what probably got him killed.
So what's the Guardian been saying about this? Because it had a big piece about it on the anniversary of his death.
Yeah, it was on the anniversary, and I presume that was the reason they ran it. But it was actually the Sunday World, which Martin O'Hagan used to work for. They've been saying all along that they know who carried out the assassination. They've even given the names to the police and named them in their newspaper, I believe. And I don't know whether they've named them in the newspaper. That might be... I'm not quite sure about that, but the Sunday World as a whole has been attacked. So it says here, the murdered reporter's friend, the Sunday World's news editor Richard Sullivan, says no one at the paper has escaped the death threats as it continues to expose the so-called paramafia in Northern Ireland, former terrorists who have moved into drug dealing and other ordinary crimes.
Well, Apparently on the 6th of April 2008, the Sunday World ran an article called "Who Killed Martin O'Hagan?" The name of the man generally believed to have killed him. Why has Robin Billy King not been prosecuted by the Police Service of Northern Ireland for the murder of NUJ Belfast Branch Secretary Martin O'Hagan? Here's a quotation from the April the 6th 2008 edition of the Irish tabloid The Sunday World, which gives the name of the man most people who have looked into the case believe shot him. But the Police Service of Northern Ireland refused to charge this man with Martin's murder, tragically, and or even question him, apparently. Tragically and unfortunately, his killers, and this is quoting the Sunday World, including Robin Billy King, have never been brought to justice. That quote was in page 22 to 23 article called "Martin was very proud to be a tabloid reporter. His work affected so many and his spirit lives on with us." That was at a tribute night for the shot. For the Shot reporter. Now, here's something I never talked about publicly before. This is me, Tony. I was lucky enough to speak to Marty just a couple of weeks before his murder. He'd called me to respond to a short classified advert I placed in the Journalist Monthly magazine, the May 2001 edition, which read as follows, and I quote, "Masons in the media," reads the headline. "I would like to hear from anyone who knows about identities or nefarious activities of Freemasons and other secret societies anywhere within the UK media for a forthcoming publication. Confidence assured." And that was my classified ad. And I gave my name and office address at the time, which was at the old coach house in Upper York Street. Well, Marty was secretary of the National Union of Journalists branch in Belfast, and he was one of several people who responded to my ad by phoning me up. And this, for the first time, is what he told me. He named several Belfast journalists who he believed were Freemasons. Firstly, Darwin Templeton from nationalist newspaper The Andersonstown, or Adamstown News. My notes weren't too clear on that. Andersonstown, yeah. And according to Marty Templeton had favoured status at the Royal Ulster Constabulary Press Office. And the suggestion here is that it was at least in part due to his Masonic membership. Echoes here of our own current phone hacking crisis, with secret relationships being nurtured between police and journalists. And certainly a Guardian article in July pointed out that these people were lured into this criminal activity through a Masonic lodge. Then Marty mentioned someone who'd held senior office at the National Union of Journalists itself, a chief sub and former NUJ Belfast branch chair, John Lay, who, he said, was part of a Freemasonic chapel in Belfast. Marty also mentioned two other journalists, Ivan Peebles, who worked in the Scarborough newspaper, and Jimmy Gracie, who worked at a paper called The Sunday Life. Marty made it clear to me that he felt membership of the Freemasons compromised the journalist's independence, particularly with the situation in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, meant that there was constant pressure to spin the news in favour of one faction or another. So what do you make of this, Martin? I mean, this is a conversation I had on the phone with Marty just weeks before he died.
Well, he was famous for looking into the what was going on behind the scenes. Although he was a nationalist sympathiser, he was actually at one stage interrogated by the Provisional IRA because they didn't like some of the things he came out with. He was a very independent-minded guy. And I understand that before he was murdered, he was warned the previous week by the a loyalist paramilitary in the street and said that, you know, you're going to be murdered. And he said, thanks for the tip-off, because he was a well-liked character.
But
he thought that he was being, and it wasn't a tip off. They were basically intending to kill him.
But why was Marty interested in this sort of thing?
Because as a journalist, he was interested in what goes on behind the scenes, I presume. He was nobody's man. I mean, I think his sympathies were nationalist. He was in Loncash. He was swept up by the British, I believe, and interned. But he was also at later stage interrogated by the Provisional IRA, basically because he was an independent person, and he always wanted to know what the hell was going on. And of course, he ultimately paid with his life. The only journalist, incidentally, to be murdered in the whole of the Troubles by any of the factions, because everybody, basically, journalists were off limits to the factions. Everybody wanted to use journalists to get their message out.
So even though the names of the so-called culprits have been circulated, why has the murder not even been properly investigated?
Well, as it says here, McDowell and Sullivan, who are both from the Sunday World, are adamant that the gang responsible for O'Hagan's death were, or still are, working for one of the security forces in Northern Ireland. So what you often have found, I mean, if you remember, Brian Nelson was the head of the UDA's chief intelligence officer, and he was working for the British Army for years. And when he was finally caught and brought to trial, Brigadier, or then Colonel Gordon Kerr, testified, oh, he's helped to save loads and loads of lives, so he was given an easy sentence and possibly disappeared and then mysteriously died. He's possibly got a new identity, nobody knows. But, I mean, the fact is that the same dirty games are still being played, and the security forces are still in league with some of the people that they claim to be chasing after.
Now, Protestants have their Orange Order. Is this something similar to these Masonic lodges? Because they have Orange lodges, don't they?
It is, but it's not quite the same thing. I mean, the Orange lodges are a Protestant. Freemasons are deist, if you like. I mean, they don't have a firm ideology.
Now, deist means basically about God, but without specifically using the Bible. It's just a sort of idea of God.
Yeah, when it first came out in the 18th century, deism was a sort of semi-rationalist creed. You know, we believe in God in a general way, but we're not dogmatic about it. The Orange Order is specifically Protestant, but of course, the Orange Order used to function in Northern Ireland in many ways far more overtly than the Freemasons as a Jobs for the Boys organisation. I mean, that's its historical role over hundreds of years.
Well, at the present time, there are Masonic lodges in the Houses of Parliament. The best known are probably the MPs' lodges, one of which is the new Welcome Lodge number 1539 and the Parliamentary Press Gallery, Lodge number 1928. In November 1997, the Home Affairs Labour MP and Select Committee Chairman Chris Mullins demanded that Freemasons Hall in Covent Garden release all names of Masonic police and MPs in connection with several corruption scandals, but they refused and the demand was batted out into the long grass. You'll find a lot more about that particular rabbit hole on the internet, including the amusing tale of Daily Express political correspondent Rob Gibson, who accidentally emailed out the minutes of his Masonic Lodge meeting to countless journalists and MPs. Then there's the tale of a spoof announcement which was made in the press gallery of the House of Commons, asking for the Secretary of the Press Gallery Freemasons Lodge to come to the office to take a phone call. The call was answered by a well-known Sunday Times political editor who said he was simply curious to know who was on the other end of the phone.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And now on to our short discussion about zombie banks. Martin, what is a zombie bank? Because they've been actually dressing as zombies over in New York and as part of this Occupy Wall Street protest.
Well, I think the phrase was commonly used in relation to the Japanese banks after the Japanese crash in the late 80s. Zombie banks basically ought to be bankrupt. Yeah, they're basically being allowed to function because they're too big to fail, but they are in fact bankrupt. And therefore they are the undead. They continue to operate, and all of the debts that they hold continue to be collected or attempted to be collected. Whereas if you bankrupted these banks in an orderly fashion, those debts would disappear. So coming back to our earlier discussion, nobody pays all their debts. You basically pay some of your debts or often none of your debts. That's the capitalist system. Debts are not necessarily to be paid. When somebody lends somebody some money, the interest rate they get paid is because of the risk that you won't pay them back. That's why they're entitled to interest. And in a certain set of circumstances, you don't get the money back. What's happened in the financial markets is that the hedge funds and the zombie banks have now lost all of their money, but they're expecting everybody else to bail them out so they can carry on existing. They're the undead. They're wandering around, and they need to be finished off like in a computer game.
Do you have to sort of put a silver stake through their heart or something?
Well, I understand in computer games you sort of blast them away with machine guns and things and slash them to pieces with samurai swords. I don't know. I mean, the fact is that they've got to be wound up. They are. We've got ourselves in the ridiculous situation imagining these people are indispensable to us, whereas in fact they are parasitic. We don't need zombie banks. We need to wind them up, and that basically includes virtually the whole private banking sector. Will have to go, and it will go.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, we look back 30 years now to the failure of Banco Ambrosiana and the discovery of its boss, Roberto Calvi, dead, hanging underneath Blackfriars Bridge. What are the lessons from Calvi's murder and that banking collapse and fraud? Do you think there's something to learn for today? So here's an extract from Granada TV's 1989 documentary Inside the Brotherhood, based on a book by Martin Short, and it features investigative journalist Paul Foote, but begins with the blood-curdling words of a secret Masonic initiation. The narrator is Martin Short.
There was likewise this cable tow with a running noose about your neck, which would have rendered any attempt at retreat equally fatal.
The cable tow, or noosed rope, is central to Masonic ritual, as is violent death.
Having your throat cut across, your tongue torn out by the root, and buried in the sand of the sea at low watermark, or a cable's length from the shore, where the tide regularly ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours.
On the 18th of June, 1982, an Italian Freemason named Roberto Calvi was found hanged under London's Blackfriars Bridge. His body was suspended from scaffolding at a level where the tide ebbs and flows twice every 24 hours, in line with the Masonic ritual. The City of London police, who investigated his death, believed that Calvi had committed suicide, but his family say he was murdered.
There was no neck damage that was found. Now, the only way that a death could have occurred without causing neck damage was by holding on to some of the bars with the ends, which of course is impossible without leaving traces of rust or dirt.
He didn't think about to kill himself, to commit suicide, because he loved the life. He loved us. He wanted to stay with us.
An Italian court decided that Calvi had indeed been murdered. One of Italy's most successful bankers, he had handled the secret finances of a powerful Masonic lodge. So was his death a ritual murder? Was he killed for threatening to reveal what Italian Masons had done with a missing £200 million? Or did he know too much about a Masonic plot to undermine Italian democracy? Calvi was boss of Italy's largest private bank, and so close to the Vatican and the Pope that he was known in Rome as God's banker. How he died 1,000 miles away in London is a bizarre mystery. Journalist Paul Foote investigated his death.
I never had any doubt about it at all. It seemed to me perfectly plain that it was a ritual murder carried out in the Masonic tradition.
Foote believes even the name of the bridge where Calvi died may have been significant. The image of a black friar is especially emotive for Italian Masons. The man who is in effect their patron saint, Giordano Bruno, was a 17th century monk burnt to death for his beliefs by the Papal Inquisition. The scaffolding from which Calvi was found hanged had been erected next to a ladder, which for Masons symbolizes death. In addition to the noose or cable tow around Calvi's neck, and the fact that his body was hanging where it was ritually covered by the ebb and flow of the tide, 12 pounds of bricks were found in his pockets. Stonework plays a central role in all Masonic ritual. A rough, uncut stone symbolizes the uncultured man before he joins Freemasonry. And a smooth stone indicates the fit member of a civilized society, which a Mason becomes after years learning the craft. Rough stones or bricks, as found in Calvi's pockets, symbolize failed or treacherous Masons.
It seemed to me that this was a Masonic ritual murder. And the astonishing thing about the whole affair was the casual way in which it was investigated by the City of London police, the casual way in which the suicide verdict was really accepted by the establishment, and that no one to this day has any real idea of how Calvi was murdered. On our soil, in the middle of our city, this thing happened, and we've no idea how it happened.
The job of investigating Calvi's death fell to the City of London Police, a small force with just 80 detectives. At the London inquest, city officers gave evidence suggesting Calvi had killed himself. His bank, the Ambrosiano, was in deep financial trouble, with £1,000 million of debts, and Calvi was facing 4 years in jail over a conviction for illegally exporting Italian currency. At the inquest, the coroner warned the jurors not to bring in an open verdict, so they decided Calvi had committed suicide. His wife felt this was an unacceptable decision, so she applied to the High Court for a second inquest. This time the jury reached an open verdict, meaning Calvi might have committed suicide, but might have been murdered.
This removes the stigma over my father's name. We think that the jury's done the best on the evidence, and it's very difficult to bring the whole picture into a coroner's court.
The whole picture would have involved revealing Calvi's secret membership of an Italian Masonic lodge. This wasn't mentioned to the jurors who visited Blackfriars Bridge during the inquest, but 6 months later, the foreman said that had they known about Calvi's Masonic connections, they would have reached a homicide verdict. Three Italian judges decided Calvi had been murdered. They were convinced by reconstructions of his death under Blackfriars Bridge, enacted 5 years later on nights with similar tides. They felt a man of Calvi's age and physical condition could not have climbed the scaffolding, especially without leaving any trace of rust on his hands, whereas he could easily have been strung up from a boat. But why would Masons have wanted to kill Calvi? Why is it even relevant to look for Masonic symbols in his death? The reason why lies in a police raid 15 months earlier on the properties of an obscure mattress manufacturer in Arezzo, Tuscany. His name was Licio Gelli. The police seized thousands of documents relating to a Masonic lodge called P2, which almost no one outside Freemasonry knew anything about. What shocked the police were the names on a list of 980 members. There were dozens of leading Italian businessmen and industrialists, and the police chiefs of Italy's four biggest cities, a total of 43 MPs, including the ministers of justice and foreign trade. There were 51 generals and admirals, and the heads of all Italy's secret services. Together, these men operated like a private government, manipulating one of Europe's biggest democracies. Leading bankers like Calvi completed the list.
When the Italian government gave out publicly the list of the P2, we were astonished. It was like discovering that Italian democracy was something else from what we had always believed. We saw that there was another something going on underneath the surface of events. And so we asked ourselves why.
The answer goes back to a bitter struggle between Freemasons and the Catholic Church in Italy, which has lasted ever since English gentlemen and sea captains introduced the Brotherhood here in the 1730s. The Church soon branded Freemasonry the work of the devil and excommunicated all Catholic Masons. Italian Freemasonry turned anti-Catholic and revolutionary and went underground. It has had a clandestine and persecuted history ever since. The Grand Orient is Italian Freemasonry's ruling body.
Contrary to what happens in England and America, where the state not only tolerates Freemasonry, but recognizes it, here state and church don't recognize it, but even condemn it without knowing it.
In 1926, Italy's dictator Mussolini banned Freemasonry. After World War II, it was made legal again, and an old secret elite lodge was reborn as Propaganda Due, or P2. This failed to recruit many members, until the Grand Master at the time asked Licio Gelli to take over in 1970. Gelli immediately set about changing the character of P2. Tonight, he speaks out in defense of his lodge.
Militavano nella P2 i migliori uomini.
Inside the P2 lodge, we had the top men Italy had in all fields, in the world of politics, in diplomacy, the top men from industry, the press, the law, and the civil service. They were all the very best. By joining P2, they wanted peace and tranquility within the lodge, so that they could all contribute in their own fields to the betterment of society.
Per poter migliorare la società.
Gelli initiated his P2 elite in a suite in Rome's Excelsior Hotel, not in a Masonic temple. It never met like a conventional lodge. Instead, select groups of members plotted to control the state, as agendas seized at Gelli's premises revealed.
The political and economic situation of Italy, the threat of the Italian Communist Party, aiming at the conquest of power, the spread of immorality, indiscipline, relationships with the Italian state.
We were striving for the improvement of society, to make a contribution, to safeguard the democratic institutions of our country. This was P2.
But in the 1930s and 40s, when Mussolini ruled Italy, Gelli was a dedicated fascist, and he's never been a friend of democracy. After the war, he fled to South America. He returned in the 1960s, when he was wealthy, respectable, and an ideal Masonic recruit.
I felt Masonry was the university where one went to learn rules of right and wrong and graduated with a degree in morals, sound principles, and ethics. These were the only reasons I joined the Masons, and I'd join them again. I have been a Mason, I am a Mason, and I shall behave all my life as a Mason.
He's a man that likes darkness. He's a man that likes intrigue. He's a man that says that like democracy, but has a very strange idea of democracy. He comes from the extreme right. I don't think he has ever left that position. His friends are still the same fascists that he met with during the war.
After the raid on Jelly's villa and the exposure of P2, it became clear that the main aim of the lodge was to subvert democracy. An exhaustive parliamentary inquiry found that P2 was a state within a state, a cell of extreme right-wingers bent on maintaining power by ruthless means. For example, in 1978, Italy's Christian Democrat Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, favoured bringing the communists into government in a plan known as the Historic Compromise. But then, Moro's car was ambushed and he was kidnapped by left-wing terrorists. Evidence which later emerged suggested that the longer Moro was held captive, the better it suited the P2 Masons who headed the secret services.
Chi avrebbe dovuto trovare Aldo Moro?
A committee drawn up from the staff of the Interior Ministry was put in charge of finding Moro. They were nearly all P2 men. Later, I was on the Moro inquiry. I read all the documents, the few there were from that committee, and I must say, dispassionately, that they had no intention of finding Moro. To leave Moro in the hands of the terrorists, to let the situation rot, was a sure way to make sure that the historic compromise did not come to fruition.
3 months after Moro's kidnap, he was found dead in the boot of a car. His body bore the marks of repeated torture.
That was Martin Short and his Granada TV six-part documentary, a little extract there, version of his book Inside the Brotherhood. That's all for this week. Thanks very much to Gary Hopkins and Martin Summers. See you next week on thisweek.org.uk to download the podcast. This is Tony.